Hello, and welcome to the One-Stop Co-op Shop podcast, your one-stop for co-op news and reviews. This week, Jason Perez is here to entertain you with some more shelf stories.
Yo, my hot peoples, what's up? Welcome back to the One-Stop Co-op Shop. I am your host, Jason, here, and today I have a huge treat for everybody. So when you hear Peter on the intro and the outro to this show, you know that we have a Discord. The One-Stop Co-op Shop Discord is a wonderful community that has all sorts of gamers, left, right, up, down, male, female, international, American. We are such a popping community. I turn off the notifications because I get ding, ding, ding every all night because people are always chatting about the latest co-op games. Often stuff that Mike is filming because he films all the greatest Kickstarters, but old favorites as well. So it is my pleasure to bring on a member of our Discord. His name is Nathaniel James. He wrote an excellent blog on BGG, which reviewed the game Primal the Awakening. If you saw the One Stop Co-op Shop, I did a video for it. I'm super excited about it. I'm looking forward to doing more. But this blog was so superlative, I had to have this man on the show. So Nathaniel, welcome to One Stop Co-op Shop.
Thanks so much, Jason. It's great to be here. And also appreciate One Stop Co-op Shop for having me.
And thank you very much for being an active participant in our Discord and, you know, popping up and down the channels. Go ahead and tell the peoples, give us an advertisement. What will people get into from your perspective as someone who is not invested in a One Stop Co-op Shop, like, you know, Empire at all, just someone hopping in. Give us your perspective on how it's been in the Discord, hanging out with our community.
The Discord has been great. It's, as you said, it's a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different people's tastes in games. You have everything from what you would expect from a co-op focused channel.
Yeah, we get solo people that are like on the Euro end. We get the people that are like minis.
Exactly. Yeah, but also I can go in and talk to somebody about 18XX train games, which are about as far from co-op,
right?
Or solo friendly. But also a lot of the games I really really love, like Primal. Spoilers. Or
spoilers.
Like KDM or a lot of other campaign games that I play with people. Yeah, it's really, really great. It's a good community. And that's really valuable.
Please go ahead and check the show notes below. And, you know, just to join the community, and if you write intelligently enough and you share enough of your thoughts, and I will bring you on the One-Stop Co-op Shop and we'll have a podcast together. So we are reviewing Primal the Awakening. This one was recently delivered. I think the Kickstarter went live in 2021, around there.
Yeah.
I remember it was at the point after it was definitely during COVID. And it was at the point where it was one of the first few really big projects that were up. So it's like, okay, what's going on here? And it did really well. It's finally delivered, you know, 2.5 years later. There's big old boxes, you know, 20, 30 pounds of game. So just very quickly, it is a card-based boss battling game in the mold of, like I said, Thrills of the Multiverse and Aeons. And you're going to get your hero, and it's going to have a deck of cards, a fixed deck for the most part, while you are playing. But then as you take down bosses and as you go through the different things that are going on, then you can improve your deck. So it's kind of a deck building paradigm over time. It's basically based on the video game Monster Hunter. And that's kind of the paradigm. So like, we'll talk about the story as we go on, and we're going to have lots to say about the story in our design section, which is after the top five. Top five, they will focus a little bit more on mechanisms. So you're there for the bosses. You're there for big honking bosses, and you are going to take them down, and you're going to level up and gear up, and you're going to take another one down.
It's a cycle of life, circle of life.
I am not a Monster Hunter fan. I didn't play the video game as much. You seem to be. When you were talking about it, maybe you mentioned in the blog as well, just like you had put in many, many hours into Monster Hunter in particular.
I don't think you can play any Monster Hunter game and like play more than, or at least once you play one, you've spent 200-300 hours. It's right. The nature of the design. You fight a monster to get its materials, to fight a bigger, to make up weapons, to fight a bigger monster, to get better armor and weapons, to fight a bigger monster. And it's designed to go on and on and on.
Until you fight the biggest monster.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And then you fight them again and again and again. For their materials to get even better weapons to fight a newer, better version of that monster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fundamentally what the genre is about. And there's something about it that I think obviously a lot of people really enjoy.
Yeah, and we'll absolutely get into what how Primal bakes it into the board game. Then there is a Monster Hunter game we have talked at least shown videos in the One Stop Co-op Shop. I haven't played it, so I can't do the direct comparison. Have you played the Monster Hunter board game?
I have, yeah.
Okay, and so maybe we can you're, along the way you can dribble in comparisons. I'm pretty sure your people are curious about that. From an IP perspective, there were some comments on both Mike's video and my video about like, hey, this is Monster Hunter. How are they getting away with this? Are the monsters kind of like analogs of one another between the two properties, or
There are definitely some similarities, and there's definitely some monsters that you look at it and you just squint a little bit and think, wait a minute, I
yeah.
know what this is. This is Toby Kadachi, except a lizard instead of a lizard squirrel. It's like there's some analogs. There's definitely some direct comparisons you can make, especially Torima, like to Baroth. Like if you look at pictures of them side by side, it's very close. But the aesthetic of each is very, very different. Primal, I think, tweaks it into a slightly more fantasy direction. Going towards their stated inspirations, Final Fantasy and a couple other games.
Dark Souls, yeah.
Whereas, yeah, exactly. And whereas Monster Hunter, for the most part, there are many exceptions. All of their designs, however ridiculous and absurd they end up being, start with something that is pretty real and identifiable, before they change it into something completely
All
different.
right. So let us get into this card-based boss battling game. As always, my friend Nathaniel over here is very familiar with the One Stop Co-op Shop format. We are going to give our top five things that we think that y'all should know about the game. They could be negative, they could be positive. They are ranked in order of importance. So you are the guest. So I will invite you to share your number five thing about Primal that you think people should know.
So my fifth thing, in a order of importance from important to the most important, I think for me, number five is crafting. And this is somewhat of a mix because the gear itself is all really interesting. It's really great, has a lot of variety, a lot of different it creates the ability to create a lot of different builds. But crafting is so fundamental to the experience, and they've put I mean, there's so many gear cards and crafting is an important part of in between each battle. You have to create new gear to be able to face the next monsters. But it ends up feeling rather toothless pretty quickly because they eased so many pain points in Monster Hunter. You have to grind a lot of monster, like fight a monster multiple times to get enough materials to create the gear you need. You don't want to do that necessarily in a game unless it's KDM.
Yeah, and I'll
And even
say,
that, it
so I should probably have pointed it out before. You can play these standalone, so you can play each monster just once and pick a level. So like you can battle at either 0, 1, 2, or 3, and you can pick a level, pick some gear and go, and they call it expedition mode, and that's fine. But then there is a system where there is a campaign where you can fight. You start at 0, and you fight a few level ones, you fight a few level twos, you fight a level threes, and then you get to the ultimate boss, which is the quote unquote awaken. There is a story that is attached, but for the most part, the reason why I didn't talk about it so much is because it is a little bit dread. It's basically it's 10 fights strung along. And there is a light crafting system where the boss will drop some mats. Usually, if you fight a fire boss, they'll drop some fire, and then you use the fire to craft your gear, and then you use the gear to kill the next monster. Pretty much a straight shot from there.
And through all of that, it ends up there's a lot of Kingdom Death monster style like gear cards that have all of the different ge elemental gears that you can forge at three different levels. So there's this whole stack of forge cards that have crafting requirements and the gear that you can craft, and that's all fun. That's neat. But what ends up happening is all of the crafting, the forge cards, all of the forges, the elemental forges that you gain access to when you fight monsters, they all level up at once. And they're all of the materials that you need to craft things, you can basically just exchange things pretty easily. So by the time you hit, I found by the time I hit the fifth mission in there, 11, 12 fight campaign, it didn't matter anymore. I was always able to forge whatever I want, whenever I wanted. Mm-hmm. So the amount of time spent crafting ended up just kind of, it almost felt like I could just like grab whatever gear I wanted at that level for that fight, which was fine. I liked that they eased the need to fight something multiple times, particularly for the shortness of the campaign. But I found that it limited the ability to choose. Like, there were fewer choices than I wanted out of that system. Mm-hmm. And I think some more limitations, just a few limitations would have made it the build choices that you had to make as you were choosing which monsters to fight next a little more interesting.
It's basically one step below a wardrobe. So you hit level one and you get your wardrobe of level one helmet. Yep. And armor and items. And, you know, it very quickly, you get to kind of wear your wardrobe, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, speaking to your point, it actually relates to my number five and also my number four. So I'll actually go with both of them and I'll hop back to you. But for my number five, it is the variation. And that's not the same thing as replayability. A lot of times variation is just bloat. And I will say a pro overall, because I found that for the most part, the variation worked. The different monsters are different. And that's what you want, right? You want the bosses to be different and have different experiences. And there's different pathing with the heroes. All the heroes feel different, et cetera. That, I think that they did a great job with that. Where I found I hit that bloat category was the gear. And especially the items, like you get really down into the weeds when you start to get, because there's a lot of powers, right? And there's a lot of like little parts of the game where you can kind of tweak things and, you know, make this more powerful, make that more powerful. That was okay. But you hit a limit when it comes to, you know, item number two and, you know, the sixth gear set of gear or anything like that. That began to feel a little bit meaningless. And also the leveling aspect of it is like, yeah, I just, this is my wardrobe now.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I didn't, I think the game wants to encourage people to kind of like play the game multiple times and wear different wardrobes, so to speak, because you get different combos and the it'll feel different. But I wasn't, to your point, I had zero desire to like craft for it. It's like, okay, I want to wear this item, so I'm going to fight this monster, and this monster is going to drop this thing, which is going to get me this item. I was like, no, I'm not doing that.
It didn't matter, because you could get that item anyway, no matter what, because you could just sub in another resource 2-to-1 or another elemental resource for any resource. Even for me, who I enjoy that aspect, it just, yeah.
And so that's my number five is variation, which is a pro, but for the most part, but except in the item and the crafting and everything, that became a little bit mixed for me. So then my number four is the leveling, and the leveling of the heroes and the leveling of the monsters themselves. So as you go in the campaign, you do get that level one, level two, level three. I thought the game did a really good job on the hero side, because as you level, you're going to get these upgrade cards. So you like your Aimerfix deck to start with, but then as you get different gear and as you level up, you get these trees that you can get. So like extra cards that let you mold your character. And I thought that was really fun, because there's different paradigms. So it's like, you know, if I'm the great sword fighter, then I can be either this barbarian that doesn't care about my health, or I can, you know, lay down some status effects, or I can emphasize movement. I have these different paths. Or if I'm the hunter, which was, I found really fun, you could either like shoot a bunch of little arrows or shut up for your giant shot, or be like a shutdown master, where it's like, okay, now I'm shooting not the enemy, but their cards, and shutting down their movements and everything. And that was the game did a decent job of, as I upgraded, letting me, you know, kind of opening up those choices for me, and letting it, you know, and letting that develop. And then on the monster side, it isn't just more hit points, right? So that's the easiest thing to do. It's like, okay, level two monster, have some more hit points. You get that. Believe me, you get more hit points. But the cards, the monster cards also swap out. And so there's improved versions of those cards. The monsters get a little bit nastier. You have to change. Some monsters actually add decks as you level. So I found that even, you know, I was It was worth fighting a monster at level one and then a monster at level three. Those felt different, the same monster. So on both ends, the hero and the monster, I found the leveling was pretty well tuned.
I have more to say about that later.
Later. All right. So what's your number four?
I think my number four is going to be the deck construction and card play itself. And the deck construction ties back to the gear, specifically the weapons, because the weapons, each weapon that you craft has a slightly different composition of attack, maneuver, dodge, and parry cards, the four different colors that make up your deck. And each weapon has a specific number of each card that you need in your deck as you build your deck. I don't like deck building games, and I actually really don't like a lot of LCGs because I don't like deck construction generally. Mm-hmm. One of the few exceptions is Mage Knight. This, on the deck side of things, that it was a very long form deck construction game. Like when you're playing the campaign from level, like the first mission to the last, you're slowly increasing your card pool very incrementally. And able to, in between each battle, like switch new cards in and out to test, you can test something out. And if you happen to wipe against the stupid crab, then, you know, you can bring in some other cards to try again.
Sure.
But, and at the same time, the card play itself, very LCG, like very, like Mage Knight, you play cards too, by paying with other cards. And it created for me a lot of really interesting tension in a given turn, because the card that has two stamina that I can use to pay for this really expensive card also has a power I really want to use. So it's very classic LCG, very like classic card game. Mechanically, it has those classic mechanics, but it's implemented really, really well. And to your previous point, it is so finely tuned that, as you're leveling up, as you're going through this process of both customizing your deck in between each battle, but in between each turn, the cards you have in your hand really, really matter. And like stringing together the combos, it felt really good when you were able to do it. And the fact that they were able to translate that card play and that deck construction into a feeling like an action JRPG that is... Yeah, the fact they were able to translate that experience and a video game into card play was just incredibly well done, I thought.
Mm-hmm. I'll say, I have a little bit more to say about this in a little bit, but I'll say for right now, speaking to your point of like the balance, I wiped, but I never got truly stomped, and I never stomped, especially if I was fighting like level appropriate something. It always felt like, you know, I was either winning solidly or within striking distance, and I could see where something went wrong, and I can change it, or I have a card in there that I thought was going to be good, and it ends up not being good, and I can swap with something else. And so the knobs between winning and losing were always there, which is hard to do in a game with this much variety, with this many bosses and this big a card pool. I'd never found that I was in one of those corners where it's like, okay, this is super not fun. So that's definitely, speaking to your point of how finely tuned the card play was. I ninja'd your number four. So let's go ahead and just go straight to your number three. Go for it.
My number three is, we're going to talk more about this later, but the narrative, the story. And I'm not going to focus on one of my most serious criticisms of it, but some light spoilers, but I'm not going to give anything away, but foregrounding what the story is, and I don't bring it up because it's central to the gameplay. I bring it up because how much of it there is, and like how much of it you like go through as you're playing. It's a mix. This is, for me, is very much a mix, mostly negative. There is some good though, and that's the way the campaign is structured. Even without the expansions, there are a lot of pathways to the final boss. They give a lot of variety in which monsters you fight. And that was really, really fun. It is individual scenarios, but the pathways through those scenarios created pretty different experiences, particularly when, as you said, the monsters themselves are very different at different levels. It does set, like, the structure does such a good point of nailing that midpoint between a one-off game, which it also has those scenarios for, and a huge campaign that's going to take hundreds of hours to occur. Mm-hmm. But on the bad side, the narrative, Primal is a game about finding giant monsters and or bosses.
That's what it
like
is.
Monster Hunter, like Dark Souls, like Bloodborne and the Elden Ring games. But unlike those games, it's not a story about fighting those giant monsters. Mm. It's a story about three people who are not your characters. And it spends so much time talking at you. And there's when there's information giving about Alboria, the last community of humans, it feels like, in this game, it's really interesting. But then in the story, it'll go into a vision or a prophecy or a long description of somebody else who, again, you aren't playing. And there's a lot of sentences about, like, there's a lot of times where there's a couple sentences about what you're going to fight. But the rest of that text, of those 2 pages, is going to be about how something mysterious is. It's really, really frustrating. If they had leaned into the primary inspirations and how those things told stories, it would have been way more engaging, especially if you're doing multiple playthroughs. Their stated intent was to create a feeling like surviving in a dangerous world, but it was instead a lot of transcripts of ad takes about archaeology.
Which we'll get to the archaeology. I don't know if I said it clearly enough. The art design discussion is going to be using archaeological tropes in board games, which a lot of board games do. And I'm the theme guy, so I'll leave the mechanisms to my computer. If you want to know how to theme a game, I'm your man, and we're going to talk about that. I was going to save that for the design discussion, but if you just quickly about the story now, the story is a full-on con for me. I did not enjoy it. It was, as you say, it was very passive. It's like I'm watching the movie of these people and I'm already at one remove because I'm sitting there with my book and I'm reading a thing and I'm watching the spirit seeker and I'm watching the commander of the group or whatever it is give the the characters that I'm controlling barely have a voice. They do have a voice, but they're kind of like, you know, dribbling in, and it's mostly to say either we got to go that way or how cool is that. That's basically the extent of, or how scary is that? That's the extent of my personal dialogue as my avatars. And the rest of it, I'm just watching very passively. And as you say, it's very, I don't want to, it might sound mean to say like the story is almost like impressed with itself. Like it is like, how cool is this world that we created? And we're going to search.
So cool.
Oh, so cool.
And the commander, she's so cool. And the prime seer, he's even cooler. And yeah. It's
and at the end, this is spoiled because you can look at the book. They actually quiz you at the end of like, okay, what did you learn about the thing? And I'm looking at these questions like, I didn't learn anything. And I'm a theme guy. I want to know about this stuff, but I was just,
why isn't the quiz so about the monsters I fought? It's like, make a quiz about that. Like, I don't want to. Right? Yeah.
I felt very disengaged by the story. And I feel bad saying that. And I know the designers are going to listen to that part of it. But, you know, got to be honest and let's see what people are. I just wasn't gripped by the way that the story was presented. It just felt like I was this very little sand particle on a big beach. And that's not how I want to feel in a game like this.
Yeah. No, I agree with all of that. I think. Yeah, what the story ended up being about, I agree, is entirely a con. I think there's a good idea in it, like in like how they structured the campaign. But why would I read that? It was frustrating. It was really frustrating, given how much else I really liked.
So, I mean, we could probably say, we'll say more on the other side because we're talking about the narrative structure right now. When we get to the design discussion, we'll talk about the actual content itself in terms of like archaeology and all that. So that was the story stuff. That was the Thanos number 3. So let's go back to mechanisms. My number 3 is the facing mechanism and the actual way that the bosses, the board play, so to speak. So I'm actually going to split up the boss fight because there's a card aspect and a board aspect. And I found that those were different enough experiences to talk about them separately. The board play was a full-on pro, and I was very surprised by that. I know what looking at the initial campaign, one of the questions was because it's a you have this big mini, it's in the space, it doesn't move at all. All it does is turn, and there are a grand total of four spaces on the board: north, south, east, and west. And when you move from north to east. And that is the basically extent of it. And it's like, okay, is that fun? Can we get fun out of that? Yes, that is actually fun. They've managed to squeeze, out of movement. There's little terrain pieces that change up, you know, the character of the different spaces that you're going in. You can either hit the boss or not hit the boss, and or bosses will have like a condition where it's like, okay, you can hit him and he'll do damage. But if you hit him in the rear, then you'll get some sort of extra special thing. And just that little bit, right? So it's like, okay, I could, you know, use my card and wail away and do, you know, some ungodly damage for the side. But if I use this card and then I sneak behind him and I hit the tail, then I'll do less damage, but I'm going to get this like other effect, like he's blind or he's vulnerable or, you know, whatever, something else like happens. And I can, that creates a lot of table talk where it's like, okay, I want to wail away, but then the great sword fighter is like, okay, but if you make vulnerable, and it was very it was very well done. It was very easy, because in order to move, you discard a card. But you, to your point before, the multi-use card aspect. So that's it introduces just another little simple thing to use the card. I have this awesome card, I could use it, or I have this, you know, this card that's great for defense, but I gotta move because if I don't move, blah blah blah. And I just found it was a light touch in a game that's pretty complex. Having a light touch here and there was very appreciated. A lot of bang for the buck in that, on the facing and the movement. So I thought the board play was a pro overall.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's interesting to bring in the Monster Hunter board game. The positioning, it has a board that you're moving across and moving through, but movement there felt spongy almost, like it mattered less. Mm-hmm. And here there's four quadrants. It's fairly simple, but I found the positioning here to be It's utterly critical, particularly with the way my next point is the reactions. Mm-hmm. Because the reactions can trigger. So for me, the reactions are a pro.
So let's talk about what are the reactions. Talk about what the reactions
so
are.
So the reactions in the game, there's a deck of cards. Each card is a monster reaction that can trigger at a wide variety of points in the game.
It's a deck of nine cards, and it's very particular to mm-hmm. the boss. It's important to it's nine because you'll see them again and again and again.
So and hopefully not in the same triggered all at once.
And then the three of those cards are going to be laid out, and then there is a wide variety of conditions that will trigger that reaction, and it could be any time during your turn. So if you start your turn at a certain place, trigger. If you trigger a trigger.
If you play a certain color card, a certain type
if the boss
of card.
Moves, if you start in water, I mean, there's all mm-hmm. these ways in which the boss, depending on who the boss is. So that happens during your turn. And this happens to be not my number two as well. So we can talk more about it. Exactly. Okay, yeah. This, the reaction system, but go ahead and finish your point.
Yeah. It's for me, it's a pro, but it also could be the thing that somebody absolutely despises about this game. Mm. Even as much as I think it works really, really well. And it's that wide variety of potential triggers, because you're going to see quite a few of them pretty consistently, and you'll get a sense of what each of them are. It's like, oh, that spinny one means like when monster turns, it triggers. That the red card, has the red icon. It's pretty clear. When I play an attack card, a red attack card, it's going to trigger. But there are a lot of them, and they're going to be going off, and keeping track of them can be hard. It simultaneously creates situations where you have this turn planned out, you play something that you know will trigger a card, but you know there's a couple different triggers, and you don't think about it, you don't realize what move the monster will make then, and then it triggers, and that happens, and then something bad happens, and then it makes the monster do something that triggers another reaction. And then the monster triggers another reaction. And then you can get this cascade of effects.
My very first Tormat play on the channel, the first round, I played all nine cards. Two players. I played a two-player game. The cards came together where I played all nine monster cards. And that happened multiple times in my playthrough. And the Tormat's like the second boss, right? Or the first boss after that prologue boss. And the prologue boss is, you know, it's okay, right? But then you get into the bosses and you get into characters that can do that cascade movement. And it can quickly become a point where either you just kind of like eat the nine cards, or you don't play, or you do something way that is not up to optimal. Like you play a couple of defense cards and like, okay, pray to the gods that you don't get another card that'll trigger. That can happen. I'm not saying that happens every time, but it can happen, to elaborate your point.
I don't think I did a full, I don't think I've experienced a full nine, but definitely almost there. But that said, like, despite how like nightmarish that could be in the actual gameplay, I found, especially as I got through my first few games, it was a lot easier. And while, yes, I did have to pay attention and then learn new triggers as new bosses came through, going back once again to Monster Hunter, it created that sense of, oh God, what's it doing? Wait, that sense of like, I'm running away from this giant monster and it's trying to kill me and I'm just barely keeping my head above water. But that increase of tension also meant like, okay, I know that could be one of two triggers. After I've played the boss, or even before finished the first fight with the boss, I know that could be one of two triggers. I know that could be one of a couple reactions. And you can start to anticipate what the monster will do and how the monster will react, which was really, really fun. And it lets you plan ahead. And then you add in the card play and like the choices you have to manage there, and things like positioning, created a really great, really interesting experience.
It almost broke my experience. Yeah, and I think you were in the channel when I was bitching about it, because I was playing the first couple and I'm like, wow, this boss is constantly playing cards at me. Like the boss, like the game is playing you. That's like a very common criticism that people have when they don't like a game. It's like, I don't feel like I'm playing a game. I feel like the game's playing me. And I definitely felt that way at times. But the card play, to your point, which I have more to say about, was good enough to where it's like, you know what, let me give it a shot. Let me just kind of dive in and give this one like a good, my full investment, right? And then, as you said, I learned, right? I learned how to deal with those triggers. I learned which cards I can kind of absorb and eat and it's okay. And which cards I could just like totally like, you know, do not ever trigger this card, let it, you know, naturally discard, or set myself up so that another character can trigger it and it's not so bad for them, and blah blah blah. Once I learned that rhythm, it became a lot better. And I began to appreciate what you're saying, like where before the boss felt very intrusive, like intrusive on my mind space, intrusive on my turn, to the point where it just like it, I felt like the balance was off. And like legit balance, like it wasn't fun. But then I got to the point where I was like, yeah, it's intrusive, but the boss feels alive. And that's what you want in this game. Like, you, because the boss is the main thing. It's a Monster Hunter game. So you want the monster to kind of feel alive in a sense. So if I'm fighting the crab monster, or if I'm fighting, you know, the one that breaks rocks and everything, I started to get that feeling of like, okay, I'm fighting this monster. Yeah. Or I'm fighting the monster that kind of changes colors and therefore changes like how it reacts to what I'm doing. And that ended up being a pro. But it started a con, so we're going to go mix. It absolutely can break someone. Like, if you're like, this is the kind of game I would struggle to, like, because a lot of my groups, I go and I bring the game of the week, and then we move on to the next game of the week, and then we move on to the next game. I would struggle to, like, make this, like, oh, let's just play Primal, because they would leave with that one impression, and that might be negative. This is definitely a game where it's like, no, we're playing this, and then we're going to play this again, and we're going to play this again. Or if you're solo, no, you're leaving it out on the table, you're going to play it again. Yeah. I think if you're that kind of co-op gamer, this game will have a lot to offer. If it's just the drop-in, then you might want to be a little more careful.
Yeah, and because of those reactions, because the way the reactions end up working in play. I don't know, the thought of bringing this to a full table of four, or
Oh,
even worse, the fifth player expansion. No,
please.
like the thought of like bringing this to a full table and like trying to like just play, that would be a nightmare. Like the only possible way is if I was running the monster and other people were playing, like if I was game mastering the game, which could be fun, but you have to know that going in, and you have to be, there's buy-in there. The reactions, again, I love them, but I think this is what makes or breaks the game for you.
I was talking with Eric Roos, the designer of Spirit Island, and he was saying that if there was a second edition of Spirit Island, the recommended player count would be 1 to 3. Do not play this game with new players at four. Do not. And I think Primal's in the same boat.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Absolutely agree.
We're on the same page with number two. Let's see what you got for number one.
My number one, in some ways, no, it ties directly back into number two. I'm doubling down. The monsters themselves. It's the reactions that, and it ties directly to the reactions, but the monsters themselves and the personality of the monsters that comes through the reactions, through the way each monster's individual car rules work, did a better job of telling a story, of creating a world, of being fun. The narrative, or just, yeah, it made the game really, really enjoyable, and the personality of the monsters themselves really, really came through. And it's not, we covered the mechanics already, but every monster really feels different. And that's so hard to do. And monsters at same monster at higher levels also feels pretty different. And I don't have the expansions yet, unlike some people. So I can't say about the non-core stuff, but in the core box, at least so far, everything feels distinct, and that's hard. I mean, that I can't. That's hard. That's so hard. And they did such a good job of making the most important part of a monster hunting game, the monsters, feel spot on.
It's kind of the plus and minus of a complex game. There are so many phases. There are so many little, like, okay, we have you have your attacks, you have your, like, the boss basically has like two main attacks. He has this currency that they build up called struggle, and they can attack you with that. Or there's a end of round attack called the attrition, which is another attack. So that is just like, why two? Why two whole phases?
And then there's, I
And then
think,
there's
one of
all the
them.
attacks that you can do from the cards. And like, so there's all these little points that's so overwhelming and so just a burden when it comes to, getting into it. And, if you're gonna be a player that's not gonna invest 100% into this. But the payoff of that, the payoff of all the complexity is that there's space to make the monsters different. And they, boy, how do they use that space? They
They
really do.
really do. And often they do it by layering on more complexity, much, much, much more complexity too, as you were saying,
There are a couple of
onto.
monsters that they're able to make them different, but not more complex. Like I remember, I played the whole campaign, right? And I think there was one, the one of the lightning monsters, Jekyros. I'd missed them, so I'm like, okay, let me jump back in and like face the ones that I hadn't fought. And I'm like, Jekyros is kicking my butt in a whole new way. What is this? What's happening?
I think I missed him on my campaign playthrough as well. Now I'm interested.
Yeah, it's a whole yeah. So we don't have to go into like stances and all that kind of
So
stuff, but
what,
yeah, all that stuff.
as a final to my number one, what's your favorite monster in the core?
Oh wow, they all cheesed me off. I mean, okay, so your number one is the monster, so you're gonna ask that question. That is not my number one. So I'll dodge your question by giving my number one. I think your number four or three was the card play. It has to be my number one is the card play. That is, again, that is what got me over the hump of a difficult entry, because the card play sung from the very, very beginning. Even that beginning deck, I'm playing the different characters, and I'm like a shield guy, you know, normally, like I play clerics and everything. Mm-hmm. So I got into the play of the shield guy, and, you know, happened to be an expert in, you know, managing struggle and putting up defense. I kind of like that play. And then going into their deck and, you know, improving it and coming up with the different play styles, I managed to get a play style going where I was, my first playthrough, I had greatsword guy and I had shield guy. And Greatsword Guy just went full barbarian. It's like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. Let's just do damage. And then Shield Guy was Mr. Assist, Mr. Support, Mr. You know, mm-hmm. pick up the slack and everything. Mm-hmm. And that, oh my gosh. I mean, I think I was posting about it. I was kind of like live posting my plays. I hit a new record in damage, 40 damage, 50 damage. Mm-hmm. Ended up, my biggest single shot was like 96.
Oof, nice.
I managed to get pretty yeah. high on at 90, and I was counting it too. It's like, oh my god, posting the memes of, like, you know, someone smoking mm-hmm. a cigarette because of the card play. And I just think, yeah. and I think you had said this in your review, which is one of the things I really keyed on, was the feeling of fighting a big monster game isn't just like going in and thwapping, right? There's going to be turns where you're just waiting. There's going to be turns where you just play defense and you play parry, you're building up. So you might look at your round tracker. It's only 10 rounds, pretty fast game. It's round four and you're a little bit behind on the because you're setting mm-hmm. up, you're setting up, and all of a sudden, mm-hmm.
yeah,
you're and I guess that's part of the greatsword thing, but like even with other builds of other characters, it kind of works out that way. Or, you know, I've had builds, I think this was with the hunter, where it was just constant damage the entire time. And I'm like, the arrow guy goes again, pow, pow, pow. And I'm like, even that felt cool. And just all that, exploring all that yeah. and enjoying it. I'm a Sentinels of the Multiverse fan. So I like mm-hmm. the play of core heroes. Like you said before, mm-hmm. I'm not a deck building person, I deck construction, but the deck construction is so light and so yeah. paint that I didn't feel overwhelmed. It's a clear number one. And it that is what will make the game a keeper. That is what will make the game kind of a lifestyle game for me. Yeah. I am in on the rest of it just for that experience. And then everything else that you said, you know, about the monster and everything. So even yeah. with the caveats and even with the story that we have complaints about, overall, I mean, this is going to be one that I'm going to be playing a long time.
Yeah, I think for most people, that will be the number one. And it probably should be because it is exceptional. It's so good. I love a lot of card games. I love Sentinels as well. Definitive Edition has been on my table a lot recently. Mm-hmm. Same with Marvel Champions and a lot of the LCGs. I enjoy them, but again, don't love the deck construction. But this, it hits so well. It hits so well in such, and you don't have to go through that. Even if you don't, that 12 scenario campaigns too much, you don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. The pre-constructed lists, or just every monster can also be a prologue monster with the starter decks. And even the base starter cards, they're so fun. It's, yeah, at every level, it's, yeah. It does such a great job bringing it back to Monster Hunter. It does such a great job of mimicking the play styles of those weapons in the video game. Mm-hmm. Everything you were describing about what each weapon was doing was with the bow and arrow, a lot of little shots are one big shot. Mm-hmm. You just described Dragon Piercer or Status Bow, like totally different gameplay styles. And it wouldn't be possible without like how well the card play is in the game.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and in general, it's a big recommend. And it's a difficult recommend because of the price tag. It's a pricey game. It's a heavy game. We feel bad at Wostock Co-op Shop because, you know, we're telling people all these awesome games and they're hard to afford. And we didn't talk about the minis. I mean, the minis, like, this could be like a $90 game, really. And with just the cards, like, because Sentinels of the Multiverse is a $60 or $70 game. And yeah. are there more cards in this game than there are in Sentinels? No. Like, if you get your fixed decks and you get your item cards, and you could put like a, I don't know, like a little teepee in the middle of the board with a north, south, east, and like that's your monster. Yeah. But they decided to go these 17,000 extra steps and give you these big fat monsters. And it just adds to the experience. And if it's for miniature painters, definitely. you know, these are centerpiece type molds that you want to feature and everything. So they went for the premium model. And I have my own difficulty with, like, you know, games that just kind of shoot for the premium and don't give us the you know, the game for the masses and everything. But maybe if this game proves that it has legs, maybe we get the $90 version. Like, there is a $90 version of the game in here. And that'll be great. You know, so if that happens, then I'd be totally for it.
Yeah, no, a standee version of this game, like more like what Oathsworn did, would also be, it would be great. I'm happy with my copy. I don't trade it in, but.
Have you played Oathsworn?
I have.
And what do you think? Compare the two real fast.
Narrative, fantastic. Gameplay, pretty good. It got very samey for me before I finished the campaign.
Yep, Oathsworn. This one's so far above Oathsworn, like, and again, boss battle and everything. But I just the way the card play in Oathsworn worked, because it was very kind of geometric, like a card did different things depending on where it was on the board, and I can see the puzzle of that. You know, my card does something here, so I'm going to wait like 3 turns so it goes over here. I can see the puzzle that appeals to a certain type of gamer, not me. I just want to like have my hand of cards and kick some butt. And with, you know, and I'm dealing with the intrusiveness of the monster, not the mechanism of a board. So every game has that limitation, right? Of like, you know, you can't just like play your cards and that'd be too easy. Like a game kind of has to give you that challenge. So the challenge in Oathsworn was the board and the challenge in Primal is where it should be, which is the monster.
Exactly.
And the fact that they gave you that experience in a way that made the monster feel alive and dangerous, even as clunky as it can be sometimes, I still think mostly it worked. I just, wow. But this one blows Oathsworn away, and I think it. Yeah. I mean, I think what was it? Kent in the Discord chat wanted us to compare the rest of them, like the Aeon's Trespass, Odyssey, and KDM, all that. This one to me is above all those, but by a good margin.
Yeah, I have a special place in my heart for Kingdom Death Monster for all of its own issues, but the combat in this versus KDM.
It's not
by far better.
You can't even.
Yeah.
You can't even.
And Trespass, I think they're comparable, but then the baggage with And Trespass is so high, getting it to the table so hard that, like, this, I mean, just like for a game to play whenever I want, it's this.
This one is not bad to get to the table. Like, this one is, again, if you've gotten Sentinels to the table, if you've gotten Aeon's End to the table, it's cards mostly, and then you take the big plastic mini and right in the middle, and then you're basically ready to go. And if you want to play the expedition, let's say you want to play a level one expedition, then, like, just take out, here you go, have some fire. And, like, take the fire gear, and, you know, and here you go. And it is so much easier to get to the table than those other ones. I think it plays better than the other ones. The ones I haven't played Aeon's Trespass, but it was so much like KDM that I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to love this. KDM, I didn't feel like the battles were tactical at all.
That is a game that took its inspiration from Monster Hunter a little too literally. And you have to fight the same thing over and over, and you have the exact same experience over and over and over.
You had to be invested in, like, the town building in KDM, and you know, the crafting was way more realized in KDM. This one is just such a light touch; you can't even mention it. So there's pluses and minuses, but, like, I'm sitting there for core gameplay. I'm not sitting there for, like, the experience over have many hours that this one blows those other ones away. Anyway, do you have anything else to say about the mechanisms in Primal?
I'm waiting. I want the expansions. I want the feather expansion. I want to know more about the other monsters and the mechanisms in them. As far as, like, other comments about things, I think we covered the main ones. And
I played the Venom one. The Venom, they do more to add cards into your deck, like negative cards. So you have to kind of deal around. Like, there's one boss that does that. I think it's the one of the water bosses put a negative card in your deck, but it's not that bad to deal with and doesn't do it that often. Yeah. The Venom bosses, they'll just inject stuff into your hand and you have to deal with it.
And it's, that's awful.
Again,
I hate that.
different play style, but you can do it. I mean, you get enough card draw, you can kind of draw through it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, a plus to the extra bosses as far as I've played so far. Okay, so let's get into theming, right? I'm a big theming person of a game. And the theme of this one is archaeology, and it's the second half of your review on BGG. It is a big part of why I wanted to have you on the game, on this discussion, because I think that the quote-unquote lost civilization is a very popular trope in board gaming, and there are some pitfalls. So you are a PhD student in archaeology. It is an interest that you have. And you seem to know a lot about it, even just as a PhD little neophyte, telling from your blog. So let's get into it. Let's get into some, like, basically, what were some of your main points? We could start with what you wrote in the blog and go from there.
So for my experience, like where I'm coming from specifically, I am a PhD candidate at a university, University of California, San Diego. And I have done field work, Belize, Texas, Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Thailand, China, India. My work looks specifically at like ancient agriculture and how ancient agriculture ties to social organization and labor. So all of that boring nonsense aside, like, I have a lot of experience. I've worked in Maya areas, in jungles, and a lot of different areas where these tropes are directly inspired from when you're thinking about something like a lost city or a tomb or anything like that. So, as you say, in board games, they are these themes, these tropes are everywhere. Everywhere.
Oh yeah.
And sometimes it's fairly benign, like Raw. I don't think Raw's theme is something that is it doesn't send that many red flags, like any red flags.
Like Raw, the Ryder Kinitzia game?
Ryder Kinitzia, yes. Yeah. Like it's okay, whatever. It's fine. It's just like you, I theme matters because games are about things. And if you just put a coat of paint on it, it's still, it doesn't necessarily make it about that thing or what that coat of paint is relevant to what the game is about.
Sure.
So the lost civilization trope that I was specifically critiquing in my first impressions of Primal is, it's common throughout board games and a lot of media. Like, and Primal itself uses it, but it is not it's not even necessarily the prime example of it. And all of it always comes back to there is some ruin, some structure, some trace of a past group of people that are gone, that are lost. And somebody is coming into a place and discovering this lost ruins, these law, like, or, and it's done in a variety of ways, but it's always about who were these people? Like, who were these people? Why did they disappear? And it's when you get to the crux of, like, why did they disappear? Mm-hmm. Why did they collapse? How did these wonderful cities, these magnificent temples fall into ruin? It's that, like, turn that things get, problematic, tricky, that I take issue, like all archaeologists really take issue with. So because, and I stated this in my review, every time historically somebody, generally a white European or North American archaeologist, has gone into a place and said those words, like, what could have happened to these people? Where did they go? Why did this city or these people collapse? You know, there's people like 30 feet away who are the ones who took them there,
right?
Who have showed them where this place was. And also there's probably written records from somebody else who tells you exactly where they came from, or like where those ruins are from and what happened to the people who are there. Whether you're in South America, Central America, in North America, a good example is the Mound Builders. They're throughout North America, throughout North America, throughout the US, there's giant mounds everywhere across the Mississippi Valley. And when the Spanish first arrived, there were people living there. They were like, everybody was there. Like, they wrote records about them. A couple hundred years later, when the US is going, there's an explosion of interest in them. And a lot of things are written about, well, the people who are around there, and I'm going to say some things that are paraphrasing, but very, very explicitly, like, what was being said. Indigenous peoples in the modern United States, they're too lazy. Like, they don't work enough, so obviously they couldn't have built these. So who could it have been? Was it Norse settlers? Was it ancient Egyptians who came in?
Aliens, dude. Aliens. It has to be the aliens.
I haven't even got, that's a whole nother podcast, man. I can't get that. But there are literal writings from like 19th century North, North American U.S. authors who are just going on and on and on about the mystery of the mounds, the mysteries of the mound builders. Where could they have gone? These people couldn't have obviously done that, because you're looking at a time, a couple hundred years of like 95% of the population dying. So yes, those places were abandoned. Yes, people didn't use them anymore, because after the Spanish had shown up, saw the people there, written about the Mississippian peoples who were living on the mounds at the time and building more, things happened, horrible things happened. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else is coming in and laying claim and making arguments and theories about who those people were.
And it's that idea of claim that we really want to talk about. I mean, it's so what we're talking about is a process whereby an archaeologist, or in games, it's always explore, right? And explore, you go into a new land. And so if you find something that no one owns, then you make claim to it. And if you have written those original inhabitants out of the story, well, then no one owns it, and I can claim it, and I can own it, and I can extract from it. And that trope repeats itself over and over. I've talked about Lewis and Clark, the game. I've talked about Lost Ruins of Arnak. I've talked about the Quest for El Dorado. I mean, you can just go on and on and on about these games it's about going into a place and museum. There's a game called Museum where it's like you go to a place, you basically take the stuff. And so there's a double level, and I don't want to get too far into it, but I want designers to kind of think about this. So on the first level, and this, I think this is where Daniel's going, like that kind of erasure is very difficult, because again, the people are still there. And you know, what we talk about is the mounds is Cahokia. And so there's a lot of different native names for it. And what would happen is, okay, so they marvel at these mounds, but then they send in their archaeologists, they send in their troops, they send in whoever, and extract artifacts, bodies, bones. And, you know, there's a whole big movement about, okay, give us our ancestors back, and give us all of our stuff back.
Yeah.
And for whatever reasons get held up, or I don't know who to give it to, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, what are we doing here? Just from a being a good citizen of the world level, that we don't want to reproduce these stories in our board games.
Yeah.
Because it reinforces the impression that when somebody finds something big, that it's yours. And it's not. It usually isn't. There's usually 30 feet away the person who knows exactly where it is and who has a claim.
Yeah. If you go back to the original source material, they'll even, like, the original explorers will comment on, like, oh yeah, they're really helpful. They showed us where all the stuff was and, like, talked about who the people were. And, oh, hey, it was sometimes, a lot of times it was them. And yeah,
right.
There's a lot of romance around the idea of archaeology, around the idea of mysteries and lost. There's always the, like, whether you go onto Netflix and watch something that's supposedly a documentary, like, there's always the, like, idea of mystery and the idea of discovery. In a way, like that idea, like we can't actually know who these people were, but they were built by people, and people don't disappear.
Right.
And every single time there are people in those places who are the descendants of people who built those things. Whether they use those structures anymore, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't live in the house I grew up in. I don't live in the state I grew up in. It's that house isn't lost.
Right.
It's just, I moved, and people, they stop using things. That's it.
Right. And so, I mean, want to make this discussion useful for like designers, because again, design discussion and everything.
Of course.
So I wanted to, let's turn just a little bit. So, okay, what impact does this have on the kind of games that stories tell? So like one of our main criticisms of the Primal story is that it does lean on that mystery a little too hard for our taste. So like, that's the core thing that people want to sell, is the mystery of it. I happen to think that the mystery covers up a claim aspect of it, but whatever, like people get enchanted with the mystery. And it's like, okay, we know about mystery. Yeah, it makes the big, you know, set pieces, and you can draw art about it. But that story is kind of worn, in my opinion. And there could be other stories told. So let's say the Primal story was about an already there civilization that was itself struggling with the monsters. And, you know, some of those, you know, different ways of fighting the monsters. So like, you have your mainline D&D class trope type thing, sword fighter, shield fighter, but then you have a whole nother civilization that has a whole nother way of fighting these monsters, and therefore opens up a whole field of mechanisms that you can play with in your game. Or you have to negotiate with these said people. So like, let's say that said people have developed some kind of relationship with a monster, or there's so many different stories that can be opened up that are, you know, if you're a good enough writer, just as cool.
Yeah.
But because we're stuck in the mystery trope, the same stories kind of get played out over and over again.
With Primal specifically, I think you could see between the lines where, like, well, we don't want them. Okay, the place is completely abandoned. There's no one there. So we don't have to worry about ideas of colonization because there's no one there. There's just ruins. Right. Nope. And at the same time, like, hints that they're returning home, but it's a home they don't know. It's a little bit of like a narrative disconnect in like how the game is trying to approach these ideas, but then it doubles down again and again. As you said, they could have just cut out so much chaff specifically, and just, the monsters have been getting worse and worse for the last two centuries. We're at our last stronghold. How do we survive this moment? Like, they could have made the place like actually explicitly their home, and just focused on the need to fight giant monsters to survive, without leaning into a lot of pretty direct like takes on Mayan art, a lot of off ideas of tribalism and primitivism.
A lot of mythology and everything. Yeah. Like, these are primordial dragons that are, you know, birthed the thing. And it's like, I didn't need it.
they could have simplified the story far more, and like made it relevant to the game, but also like not replicate stories that are actively causing harm to people, living people now. And it would have made it a better game. And it's
in
just,
our opinion,
in our opinion,
we got to cover that whole thing. Yes.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it would have made it a better game.
Sure.
But it's because it's so easy to do, because the reality like of what people do, quoting myself from that first impressions I had, is always so much more interesting. It's always more interesting than like, what could they have done? What could have happened? They were so advanced. Obviously, it's people's lives, people's material culture is always more interesting in the reality than those tropes. Mm-hmm. And they're not needed.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, I again, this is going to be something I wanted to kind of like laser in and give something useful for designers, hopefully to think about. Right. And when you're making, and look, this is not to say that we don't want any lost ruins games, or it is not to say don't deal with archaeology. I just think that there is a way that it has been told in the past. And, you know, if you actually ground yourself into some of the real things going on and take more of the fiction often directions that are grounded in what's happening, then you might get better stories and you might get better games and you might go in different directions and hit, you might unlock new mechanisms, you might unlock new monsters. There's all sorts of weird things that can happen that are wonderful for and benefit us all.
I think paying attention to your inspirations and what those inspirations are and like what is the underlying, where those inspirations come from. Because if you delve into a lot of the inspirations behind these tropes, you're going to find some pretty awful stuff. Sure. And you don't have to dig deep. Archaeology pun.
I'm like looking at you. Oh, yeah, he made a pun. Well, awesome. So much. Thank you so much, Nathaniel. Once again, in the One Stop Co-op Shop Discord, we have these conversations and, you know, it's very respectful and we go back and forth and there's people that disagree. So it's like, okay, we have that discussion. If you don't agree with this, then that's great. You know, and we welcome that kind of, you know, back and forth and, you know, talking about the mechanisms and, you know, so we could in the same Discord, you can have a discussion about archaeology and you can have a discussion about Primal versus KDM versus Aeon Trespass Odyssey. It's just like, it's all a one big happy family. So take this podcast in the spirit of, this is an awesome community, and I want to talk to every single person in it who has something to say, and there's a lot of people who have a lot of great things to say. So, Nathaniel, thank you so much. That blog was a pretty good blog. I mean, do you have you written elsewise, and do you plan on making content in some form or fashion?
I am in the end stages of my PhD, so that is... my life, but it's, you mentioned KDM before and I have as well, but the thing I'm writing now and the thing I'm working on now is another take on Kingdom Death Monster and why I love it, and it's because I think it is fundamentally a materialist text.
Yes.
And it has a materialist view on history, which, mm-hmm. as an archaeologist who deals only in materials, find very appealing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I have a few more random things I'll be writing. But
awesome. So, and like I said, join us in Discord and join us, you know, in all the places. We got the YouTubes. We have Patreon. So if you like what you hear, then please contribute to our Patreon. We have, obviously, this podcast. And so we're a multi-platform gaming empire, as I like to say. So Nathaniel James, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about Primal the Awakening.
Thanks so much for having me. It has been really great.
If you can change your mind, it can change the world, people. So until next time, later, everybody.
Thanks for joining us again for the One Stop Co-op Shop podcast. Check out our YouTube channel at One Stop Co-op Shop. Also, join us for games and discussion on our Discord channel. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/onestop or leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another top 5 list.